You know, that that one where you're a kid, you're always going, well, why was I born in this family? You know, why wasn't I born in my friend's family? Or why wasn't I born like that person? You know, why do I have this kind of face instead of, you know, somebody really gorgeous or something? and just really questioning those kind of things. You know, why were we born as we are? So, you know, that, so kind of a curious childlike questioning that had gone on, and yet still this sense of real looking at how is it that my tendency is I feel that reincarnation is something very appropriate, tangible, and makes sense. You know? So anyway, I wanted to read something that His Holiness the Dalai Lama had said. As we look at this idea of reincarnation. And he says, as sometimes I say, although perhaps I'm being controversial, but in a way I'm getting to the crux of the matter, that even if one does not believe in reincarnation, it does not matter. And even if one does not believe in the law of actions and their consequences, it may not matter. For as long as one lives, one must maintain a noble and virtuous mind, a good heart, and an altruistic attitude, because even though one may accept reincarnation, completely understand all the ins and outs of the law of karma, of what use is such an understanding if one keeps a poisonous mind? Someone who knows nothing about such topics, yet keeps a noble and virtuous mind and helps others to his ability, need have no fear of his rebirth when the time of death comes. It will surely be beneficial. There is nothing superior to that thought of cherishing and benefiting others, the thought concerned with their welfare and happiness. This is what I usually think and say. So that whether or not one accepts doctrines and religious beliefs, the essential practice is to maintain a good heart and to consider others before oneself. If one keeps that state of mind, it is always helpful and most beneficial. So this is what His Holiness is saying, that you don't really need it as long as you're carrying this virtuous and kind heart and you watch your actions. So I mentioned this to Geshe-la, to Geshe Gelson, and he said that without a belief in reincarnation and karma, one cannot attain bodhicitta and enlightenment. So, you know, you're looking at what His Holiness the Dalai Lama is saying as something of skillful means in the way of how when we develop a kind heart that's benefiting others, then you really come to this place of thinking of others in a beneficial way, regardless, you know, and overcoming and overriding our sense of bias and discrimination towards others, if you really have this view. And then, you know, it's like the best place to start, because it's true, someone may have incredible understanding of all the philosophical tenets, but really be unkind or very narrow-minded in other ways. No, so he's saying that view, this having a kind heart, overrides everything, really. And so, you know, this sense of what Venerable Geshe Gelson is saying of having this, that having this understanding of reincarnation and the law of karma is essential to really develop bodhicitta and enlightenment. So I think, you know, it's at that point where you come to refine your view, refine your understanding and your particular practice, you really need to then transition to this place of deeply understanding how we, you know, this the view that the Buddha taught of pratityasamutpada, which is dependent origination, this idea of interdependence. And when you go into this view of interdependence, then you can go more and more carefully, and the idea of reincarnation, past lives and future lives, begins to make more sense. You know, so he says the more you study and go deeply into your practice, then this comprehension of reincarnation and the law of karma become more and more potent. Okay, so so going from equanimity to all beings are my mothers, you know, again, is where I wanted to look at today, so that we can really make that bridge between step one and step two in this 11-round practice. So, you know, it's like really looking at tracing your consciousness back into time and seeing that there's no beginning. You know, it's like even looking at your earliest memories, you know, from the time you were very, very little, and contemplating, how did I view the world? How did I apprehend the people that were in my world around me, my teachers and friends and family members, my siblings? Now, how did I hold that? And really seeing how, you know, the way you acted and worked with that was very different from someone else in your classroom. That we all had very unique ways, you know, and that we looked different and our families were different. And it's quite powerful to think of, well, what were the causes and conditions that created who I was and my particular views. And so again, we start looking at causes and conditions, you know, the causality side. And pratityasamutpada, you know, this codependent origination really has us look at that. So in looking at these conditions, you know, this is the main teaching that the Buddha had come to when he, on the night of his enlightenment, when he sat under the Bodhi tree and attained enlightenment. One of the first phases of his of that evening was really reviewing and seeing his previous lives by tracing it back, looking at what kind of lives he led. And then, you know, this is where the Jataka tales had come in. The Jataka tales are the life stories of the Buddha before he became a Buddha. What did the Buddha do? What were the causes and conditions that led up to his being a Buddha? How did he live his life? You know, and if we can attain that state, what do we need to do? What kind of actions and activities and motivations do we need to have in order to cultivate the causes for us to become enlightened as well? You know, how do we attain that liberation and enlightenment? So so there are many amazing stories of the Buddha before he became a Buddha, even in the life he led, in the life he became a Buddha. But there was one where he was born a young prince, and he had walked into the forest with his two brothers. And he saw a starving tigress, and he encouraged his brothers to leave the forest, and he offered his own body to the starving tigress so that the tiger could become resuscitated to feed her baby cubs, because if the tigress died, the baby cubs would die as well. And so the young prince stripped all his clothes off and lay down in front of the tigress so that the tigress could have some food. And the mother tigress was so exhausted and starving that she wasn't even interested in his body. And so the young prince then got a rock or something to cut into his body to get the blood flowing, and with the smell of the blood, then it arose the mother tigress to devour the Buddha, or the young prince. You know, and this is the way he had offered his life, one of his lives. So, you know, you think, if I've had many lives, how have I been using my lives? You know, what are the causes and conditions as to why I got this one this time around? You know, and so this is the way he had used one of his lives. And, you know, to again, thinking about our motivation and our intention and the way we act as we try to do virtuous and non-virtuous actions. What is compelling us behind that? What is a mental state behind all our good actions? You know, they say many times when we do something really good, we want to make sure everybody sees that you're doing the great action. You know, it's like, hey, look, I'm going to make this donation. Do you see? Does everyone see I'm making a nice donation today? And they say when you engage in negative actions, when you do something non-virtuous, then you want to go hide behind the staircase in the dark so that nobody sees you, you know. But they say it's like taking poison. It's still going to get to you, you know. And then looking at how difficult it is, even when you come up with the resolve to help people, then still people are so difficult to help. You know, you help them and then they don't appreciate it. I mean, it's just terrible. And then we get disappointed and discouraged, or you know, we want to stop. It's like Shariputra, they say, stayed within the realm of arhat, you know, where you attain liberation for yourself. You don't go on to the bodhisattva view of working for the benefit of others, because at one point, you know, he was trying to practice the path of the bodhisattva, and someone asked him to give his arm. So he cut off his arm, and he's handing his arm to someone, and the person is saying, you're supposed to hand me your arm with your right arm. You're handing me your arm with your left arm. That's impolite. I don't want to accept it, right? And you see that how challenging it and difficult it is. And you watch in your own self when you are with other people, how receptive and generous are you in receiving gifts of others? You know, when people offer us gifts or try to do kind things for us, how much are we still in this yammy, yammy mind being really critical about what they're offering us or what they're doing? And, you know, I mean, that they could do it when I'm not as busy, or they could do it with a little more flair, or whatever. You know, it's like the mind is just so critical. So to see, you know, how can we be a little more receptive and generous in our interactions with others? So so it's very hard to develop a sense of real openness and kindness with this strong wish to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings, which is, you know, this view of bodhicitta. Bodhi means awake, enlightened. Citta is mind. So the mind of enlightenment. You know? Geshe is saying we need bodhicitta this bodhicitta and the view of understanding, of having this understanding of reincarnation in order to attain enlightenment. Without, we cannot get there. So So at one point, you know, in the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, he reviewed all his previous lives, and then he came to this view of interdependent origination. So this is like the key pivotal piece in Buddha's teachings. And this is what the Buddha had said at the time when he was reluctant to teach. Because at first, remember, the Buddha wasn't going to teach this. Yeah? And this is what he said when he contemplated this view of dependent origination. Monks, the thought arose in me thus: this truth which I have realized is profound, difficult to see, abstruse, calming, subtle, not attainable through mere sophisticated logic. So, in other words, we can't just attain it through our intellect. It's something that you really need to get in your guts, like this sense of reincarnation, you know, this sense that you've had other lives before. So he says, but beings, so now he's saying his reason why he was reluctant to teach. He says, but beings revel in attachment, take pleasure in attachment, and delight in attachment. For beings who thus revel, take pleasure and delight in attachment, this is an extremely difficult thing to see. That is the law of conditionality, the principle of dependent origination. Moreover, this also is an extremely difficult thing to see. The calming of all conditioning, the casting off of all clinging, the abandoning of desire, dispassion, cessation, nirvana. If I were to give this teaching and my words were not understood, that would simply make for weariness and difficulty. So he's saying we're too attached to our pleasures to even be interested in that. And then even more than that, you know, that it's possible to let go of all of that and to really attain nirvana. Okay. So again, remember, keep in mind, we're still trying to look at this view, the second point. What was the second point? All sentient beings have been our mothers, or are our mothers. All sentient beings have been our mothers. Okay, so we're looking at that, and so we're trying to understand that leap, and where do you get to that? Where do you get to that analysis? So I wanted to kind of go over a different way, because I've gone over this several times before. This is the wheel of life. So you're looking at how we talk about being in samsara. Okay, what's samsara? Cyclic existence or unenlightened existence. Unenlightened existence versus enlightened existence. So this is a view of unenlightened existence. And we're looking at how we're caught in samsara. Okay, so I just wanted to go over it again to see, well, how are we creating these causes for endless rebirths? And why do I reincarnate again and again and again? What's going on? So I thought this was one way of looking at it to get a sense of the view of reincarnation. So this is the Lord of Death called Yama, the Lord of Death, and he's holding up a picture to you. He's holding up this picture of what samsara is all about. This is your life. Okay? This is your life. So he's holding up this view of how we're caught again and again in cyclic existence. And so there's the Buddha up on the top left there, kind of showing the way. So in whatever realm you're in, generally they say that there's a Buddha that's showing the way how to liberate sentient beings. Because, you know, as we said, the refuge prayer, you know, may I be able to liberate all sentient beings. You're looking at all these beings in these different realms. But as to how we get caught in this, where did it, you know, in Buddhism, they say that there's no original cause. There's no first cause, there's no beginning. We've had beginningless lifetimes. You know, so you look at the way and how in the Western materialistic view, we've looked at science and looking at matter, you know, looking at matter and philosophy more, but this, when the scientists have said to the Dalai Lama, there's this view of the Big Bang, everything started with the Big Bang, right? Is that how we started? No? So the Dalai Lama is saying, well, in order for there to have been a Big Bang, there must have been other bangs before that, right? There must have been other Big Bangs before that that led to the particular Big Bang you're speaking of. So he's saying there must have been a cause for that Big Bang. How can there be a causeless cause? Now, how can there be a causeless situation? What caused me to be who I am the way I am and have this kind of particular body? So, you know, it's like looking at what caused who I am. So, you know, generally, they're saying at the center of this is the three poisons or the three, the three poisons. So there's a pig which represents ignorance. Now, of course, you know, in the general sense, they say of all animals, the pig is one of the smartest animals. But so this is just symbolic, okay? It's just symbolic. So the pig represents ignorance, and then the bird represents attachment. So here it's a very colorful bird, attachment. And then the snake represents anger. So you've got these three, and they're all biting each other's tail. Okay, they're all holding each other's tail, and they're all in this place of being stuck, and it just causes each other. It all fans each other. So that's the center of it. And then here are falling into lower realms and then attaining virtuous qualities to attain the higher realms of existence. So we're constantly in this wheel, this circle of looking at our activities of non-virtue creating suffering and virtuous actions creating happiness. But it's still within cyclic existence, isn't it? So so this idea of how did we create that? We're looking at this first one here. Let me see. Need something here. Okay. This first one here is showing an old woman who is blind and she's walking at the edge of a cliff. Okay? So sometimes they show it as a man, sometimes it's generally it's a blind grandmother. Okay, so she's kind of like the bearer, the grandfather who's so it starts with ignorance, about ready to fall off the cliff. And then the second one is a potter who's forming pots. And so it's so ignorance and then formations. You're creating the conditions through the past. So generally, these are volitional impulses, and these are past causes, the past here. And then the next one is a monkey climbing in trees. And that's consciousness, your consciousness, and then it's being impelled by different things. You know, it's like jumping here and there and running about. And so this monkey represents your consciousness, impelled by ignorance and the volitional impulses from the past. So, you know, you look at this consciousness that you're born into this lifetime around, right? This lifetime around. How is it that you view certain things the way you do? It's really coming from the past causes here. Can you see it okay? Can you see it somewhat? Okay. So the next one is a man in a boat, and that represents name and form. So you're coming into taking a body. You're taking a body. The man in the boat, the man represents consciousness, and the boat represents, you know, your passenger vehicle, your body. So name and form. So these are people in a boat. And then the next one is, does someone want to sit here and explain what they're seeing? Oh, good, Erica. Great. Okay. So, I mean, just your impression of it.
This okay, is a what little is, city.
It's a little city, but what's different about that city?
There are no roofs.
There are no roofs, and there are no people. It's kind of empty. Okay, so you're coming into these are called the sixth sense bases. So it's an empty house. The bases are there. What are the sixth sense bases? Okay. Right, okay. But so it's the bases are there. The visual, the audio, the olfactory, the gustatory, the tactile, and then the mental consciousness. Okay, so those are there. And then what's in the next picture, Erica?
Well, there is a man and a woman making out. The man is dangerously close to the woman's breast. They're under a tree.
Okay, so there's a couple making out under a tree, and they're touching each other. Okay, so so this represents contact. Contact. So it's just, you know, it's like you realize you have these sense bases, but then now at this point you're making contact. So the eye is seeing, right? The nose is smelling. The ear is hearing. The tongue is tasting.
Okay. Uh-huh. I had a question about that. When you see the sixth sense bases from the previous one, that's actually, it's just the consciousness that goes with each sense, is that right?
It's an empty house because now it's just the form, those bases are there, okay? But yeah, there are consciousnesses with each one, but it's when you have contact that the consciousness kicks in with it, yeah? Okay, and then the next one, what do you see?
Man who is either stabbing himself in the eye with an arrow or plucking the arrow out.
Okay, so there's a man with an arrow stuck in his eye. What do you think that means?
Ignorance.
Yeah, it's feeling, okay? And it's such a powerful image to me. It's this particular one is very impactful for me. It's like an arrow in my eye. But all it says is this is feeling. Feeling, okay? And what is feeling?
Emotions.
No, feelings are not emotions.
Like something or dislike it.
Yeah, classically, feeling is pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. That's all there is. But it's like an arrow in your eye. How can pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral be like an arrow in your eye? What do you think?
This one might be unpleasant.
This one?
Huh?
It's
certainly unpleasant.
It's certainly unpleasant. I get the sense that this arrow in the eye for feeling, just feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, feel, it means that this one is so powerful. It is so impactful because just from pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, everything else issues forth. It's really amazing. Just from that arrow in your eye, feeling. Yeah, it's just pleasant. But when pleasant comes up, how do you act? You want more of it. If it's pleasant, you want more of it, right? If it's unpleasant, you want to cut it off. You want less of it. You want to get away from it. and then develops aversion. Huh, Pam?
So is perception in there?
No. This is just feeling. This is only feeling. Only feeling. You think about it. You know, it's like, how do you come into being with how you act throughout the day, what you engage in, what you direct yourself to? No? This one is so powerful. Feeling, the arrow in the eye. Pleasant makes you want to gravitate toward it more. Unpleasant, you want to get away from it. Yeah, neutral, you're just kind of confused. You want to check it out a little more. Yeah? Okay, so what's the next picture, Erica?
It's a man in a chair who's probably wealthy, being served by a woman, tea.
Okay.
Yes, she's pouring the tea in the cup.
Okay, so it looks like there's this wealthy man sitting at a table, and he's being served tea by a beautiful woman. Okay, so from feeling we go to
craving.
It starts, the register starts to go up a little hotter, right? Craving. It's so. So this one it's saying, One translation says a person is drinking alcohol, right? So the craving is being magnified. It's like the intoxication begins, the intoxication for grasping out of things. Okay, so what's the next one?
Monkey swinging and eating.
So a monkey swinging in a tree and eating, okay? Okay, so what do you get from that? Monkey swinging in a tree. And eating fruit. He's grasping at the fruit. It just comes automatically from the craving. Okay, so from the craving comes the grasping. You're reaching out now for it. You're going for it. You're going for it. So think about how, you know, you have this feeling, the arrow in the eye, feeling pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Then it goes to craving and into grasping. Okay. Then, what do you see in this next?
There's a woman who is at the end of a path. She looks like she's leaving home, and she is, well, sad. I thought she was crying at first, but she's not. She's bereft.
Okay. So what Erica is seeing is a woman who's down at the end of the path leaving a house. But when you look at different explanations of this wheel of life, there'll be many different caricatures. But this one is called becoming. It's called becoming. Not that she's becoming, but becoming is something is beginning to take form, okay? So here it's saying, at the time of our death, okay, she's not dying here, but at the time of our death, this becoming is generally represented by a pregnant woman. A pregnant woman. So, but here the explanation is saying, at the time of death, you begin to ripen karmic seeds in your consciousness. Now you think about at the time of death, what's going on? It's like a closure at the end of this life, but you also have your particular views about how you hold what life is all about. You know, you have these particular views and conceptions about what your life is, what happens, where you're going to go. And so here at this time of death, it begins to ripen karmic seeds in your consciousness. So this is creating the potential for the impressions leading to a new life. So it's leading to rebirth. But this is still, it's saying, becoming, she's pregnant. Okay, and then the next next painting?
A very violent childbirth. Violent and uncomfortable childbirth from the look of her face.
It's just childbirth. Okay, so the next is birth, okay? Giving birth. So this is actually at where we're propelled into our next life. We're thrown into our next lifetime. But, you know, even though this is showing birth, what the commentators say is that when we take birth, it's actually really at the time our subtle consciousness joins with the at conception. Okay, so at conception is when birth begins, your new life begins. So here, even though it's showing a woman giving birth, it's like this is your new reincarnation coming, your new life coming. Okay, and then what's the next picture?
It's a wrapped up corpse being born by four people into a charnel ground. There are skulls and bones.
Okay, so it's someone carrying, it's four people carrying away a corpse. So this is aging and death. People are carrying a corpse. So in other words, where we are in our life, and here's the wheel of life. You could say one expression of it is between here and here. This is where we are. We're between birth and our corpse being carried away. So we're kind of right here. This is your life, this line. Wonderful. Is that what you said? Wonderful. Okay. So we're in between conception and death. And so what we're doing here in this particular transition is that we are being carried along by the flood of our karmic actions and our impressions and our ripening karma, experiencing happiness and suffering and all of these things. This is going on through the karmic conditions that we had created in our past. You know, so the actions of what we're creating right in here, the actions of what we're creating are creating the conditions for our next life. Yeah? So all of the teachings that we engage in, you know, are looking at our conduct, and our ethics, and really looking at our view, because, you know, if we continue to cycle, thank you. You can go back to your seat. Thank you. If we continue to create negative actions, we create causes to experience unpleasant and difficult circumstances. If we create virtuous actions, we create happiness. So, you know, you think about it, that if this life, which seems so powerful and so long and so important and so complicated, you know, this is just one life in the realm of going through this, cycling through this again and again to infinity. Okay, so we've had endless lifetimes, and so it's saying here, you know, it's like when we engage in negative actions, it leads to a negative result. When we engage in positive, virtuous actions, it leads to happiness and pleasant results. And then if it's both mixed, the result is also mixed. So you look at karma in the way of experiencing a fully ripened effect, or an environmental effect, or a result similar to the cause. So in other words, you know, you look at the environment that you've been born in and your life, you've created that. You've created the circumstances. You know, in Buddhist teachings and practices, you know, it comes down to It comes down to you. What kind of causes are you creating for the rest of your life? You know, what conditions are you creating for later on in this life? Because those will ripen and you will experience them, right? They say you will not experience something that you did not create the causes for. That one's a really powerful one, you know, especially when we feel so insulted by something that it seems like had nothing to do with it, you know, that we seem totally innocent and something just blasts us. And you wonder, where did that come from, right? So, and then to think about it in the way of, it's ripening from my past. I created the causes for this. If I did not create the cause, I wouldn't experience the result. The thing that gives me solace, you know, is that one where you think, if I can't experience or recall any situation or circumstance of having created the causes for that, yet it ripened, then when the teachers say you can rejoice, you can still rejoice, thinking that it is from previous karma, from the past, ripening, coming to fruition, and therefore ending. You know? So in other words, something difficult happening could have been you know, what you experience as a headache or sickness could have perhaps in other circumstances caused something much more heavy as a heavy consequence. So the environmental effect is, you know, you look at the environment you live in and the, you know, it's like, where was I? I was in India at one place, trying to attend some teachings, and it was so dirty. It was just unbelievable. It's like stuff would fall into your food. You know, there were flies everywhere, and everything had dust on it. It was like being in a dust storm all the time with all these pests everywhere. It was really obnoxious, you know. So anyway, you know, thinking of how do we create different causes for this. So any questions on this particularly?
Well, on the monkey, the first one?
What was the first monkey? Okay, the first monkey was consciousness. Yeah, where... And generally, this is what's being carried into your future lives, what you had created from the past and the kind of consciousness you have now. Yeah? You look at the imprints you've had from the past, and so, you know, they call this cyclic, that it just goes round and round again, many, many different lifetimes. Any other questions?
Mm-hmm. If the... Between birth and death is the lifetime that we're in. Mm-hmm. And where are all those other things happening?
Yeah, they're created from...
they happened in previous lifetimes?
Yeah, but there are many, many different cycles. Some say this happens also in one instant. Some say this is like one lifetime. Some say two lifetimes, some three lifetimes. It's different ways of interpreting it. Yeah, but within this particular scene, you can say you're in between birth and death.
But all that's of that right. is with you. Constantly.
Yeah, and you're constantly creating, you know, from that arrow in the eye, from that feeling, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, then goes the craving, grasping, you know, and then you're creating the karmic action that you will experience in ripening later, too. So one representation, okay, so the ignorance and the volitional causes, the potter creating the wheel with your volitional experiences, that's a past cause. The present result, so what you're in now, your present result, is consciousness, the monkey, the body and mind, the sense bases, the contact and feeling. That's your present life. present result from this, your present result from this, and the present cause that you're creating now, you're creating the causes now, are the craving, grasping, and the becoming. You're creating the causes now for your future lives. And the future result is you're creating more lifetimes here. You're creating more future births and deaths. It's kind of exhausting, isn't it? Maybe you have a question?
Could you talk about more about the volition?
The volition. That's kind of like the... It's showing a potter shaping the pots. By your previous conditions in the past, you're creating different, intentions, propensities, tendencies to do things. So it's the volitional impulses of, I can read some of this too. Volitional impulses appear in the past life, while becoming occurs in the present life segment, but each plays a decisive role in the life that you appear in, and so they have similar meanings, differing only in emphasis, it says. So it says it's specifically a factor of intention, cetana, which is the predominant factor in the creation of karma. So it's volitional impulses that create the karma, because you have a kind of a propensity towards things. So it's like we have a similar experience or object in front of us, but all of us interpret it and act on it differently. So it's like your volitional impulses being unique to you, and also being influenced by so many different other factors. Okay.
Is that where perception would fall?
I'm sorry?
Is that where perception would fall?
Form, feeling. I think now you had asked if perception was up there.
After the city.
Yeah.
Feelings.
Right. Feeling. One feeling. I'm not really sure, because that's a different classification, Pam. No?
Well, it's like, well, if something were to happen, and I look at it as a certain way, and somebody else looks at it as the opposite way, but it's the same thing.
Yeah, I think those are volitional impulses, but it's different than perception. Perception is still, I think perhaps you're right, it comes up more in the couple embracing one. Yeah. Yeah. Because this one is not, it's the impulses. This one is more the how we have a tendency toward.
Something, okay. You have to come in contact with it, right?
Yes. That's why you have the contact. Yeah, exactly. Okay.
And you perceive with the senses.
That's why the senses are, and then look at the senses that you have. Yeah. I mean, you need, like they say that generally someone cannot be ordained as a monastic if they are they have completely faulty senses, like if they're mute or something like that. That's one very strict interpretation, and yet on another, like I know with the Tibetan masters that they've ordained people with different kinds of handicaps, because the Vinaya, the ordination level is one level of ethics, whereas the Bodhisattva ethics are a higher ethics. And so even though maybe on a Vinaya level regarding our monastic vows on a very strict level. Someone cannot be handicapped or mute or something like that. The Tibetans will still ordain them, you know, because of the Bodhisattva vow being higher. So it all is very depends on the teachers. Yeah, depends on the teachers. So so anyway, this is one interpretation. It's just symbolic, but it's looking at how do we create the conditions for our next life, you know, and also where did I come from? So this is just one interpretation. We're continually creating more and more causes. So that's why they call it cyclic existence, or on it endlessly. Okay, so there's no beginning, but there is an end. Okay, so when you get off the wheel of existence by attaining insight into the nature of reality, you know, you begin, you see it directly, and you create no more negative actions. Because you see things directly, you don't see them with faults anymore. You know, actually, this one that starts ignorance, even though that's the number one, it's not the root cause, because there are causes and conditions for that too as well. You know, so it's looking at how you know, if we can develop an understanding of the nature of reality and see directly, then you cut the causes for further existence, and then you go into the realms of, you know, the bodhisattvas and the arhats and bodhisattvas and the Buddhas. So they say that this is attainable, you know, and so Geshe-la at times has taught this, you know, the stages of the path of where we get to. Okay, any questions? Any further questions?
It seems like a lot of times Geshe-la says the cause is karma and collision.
Yes.
So what does that fit on?
Well, karma is coming from the conditions that you created in the past, the ignorance and the volitional causes.
Yeah, but the way you're talking about it, this volitional cause, it seems like it's not everything to do with karma. It's just some aspect of karma.
Yeah, it's the impulses, but it's all being formulated there,
so
along with
the second one is basically karma.
Yeah.
And the first one is
Klesha are these. Klesha are, you know, are delusions, are ignorance and attachment. So that's driving it there. The attachment, aversion, ignorance are all driving it. So, you know, can see if this is if that's the hub of the wheel of life, you know, we should really try to cut through our attachment and ignorance and aversion, so that we can, you know, like the bodhisattvas, they say, are our holy masters. Then at the time of death, and what they've used their life very, very well, and then they choose where they're going to be reborn. You know, how much choice did you have this lifetime around? You know, and to think about the parents that you have of this lifetime, and the people that you encounter, and it's so amazing to think of the bodhisattvas' wish to keep coming back, even though they don't have to anymore, to deal with us, you know. And how fickle we are, and you know, it's really quite amazing. So the bodhisattva vow, like Geshe-la is saying, you need that. You need that understanding of bodhicitta, and an understanding of reincarnation to really attain liberation and enlightenment. So, you know, so think back to the beginning where I read that His Holiness said, you don't need the understanding of reincarnation and karma, but if you're a good person, so, you know, it's, again, skillful means, looking at how do we get to that place of deeper understanding and to cut the causes for continued unenlightened existence. How do we create the causes for better lifetimes? So, you know, it's, again, this is just one presentation, and this is another saying of the Buddha. He says, whether a Tathagata, an enlightened being, whether a Tathagata appears or not, this condition exists. This condition exists, this cyclic existence. And it is a natural fact, a natural law that is the principle of conditionality. Principle of conditionality. So in other words, you know, it's like this is a Tibetan depiction of these links, but in other countries, you know, they still have that, but it's not done in these kind of pictorial expressions, but it's still the teachings of what the Buddha taught. So, you know, it's again something where like His Holiness says, you know, if you can understand it intellectually and know all the ins and outs of it, but if you're an unkind person with a poisonous mind, it's not going to benefit you at all. Yeah. Okay. So I think it's important for us to check our understanding and our perceptions, our volitional impulses, and really look at our own belief system regarding life, our expression and our lifestyles. You know, in Colorado, they have this thing called the street retreat, and it's led by someone named Fleet Mall. The street retreat is where people go. You have to show up in downtown Denver in this funky area, and you live like a homeless person. And I'm not sure how long it is. It's like a long weekend or a week where you just show up and you don't bring any money and no ID and no change of clothes. And you just live like a homeless person down in the streets of Denver. And you have to find places to eat, you have to find the soup kitchens and where you can find shelter, and then also, you know, even at the end of the retreat, you have to panhandle your bus fare home. So, you know, it's an experience of just yanking you out of your own soft, cushy lifestyle and experiencing what a lot of human beings experience. And more human beings are experiencing, you know? And it's like, we're lucky we have soup kitchens and we have shelters. It's just really amazing. So, you know, it's like, as we contemplate these things with controlled air and controlled light and a nice carpet and nice cushions, you know, we can go back to our comfortable lifestyles. But, you know, to think that this is going on for all beings, and to, you know, have this kind of opportunity to see what do other beings live like. Very powerful. So when you're living in the street, in this kind of street retreat, and to think, you know, all beings have been my mother. It gives you a whole other perspective. I had a friend who went on that retreat, and he said he panhandled his bus fare home, you know, and he knew his wife was making a really nice dinner for him from being gone for so long. And yet, you know, he says he's taking the bus home and he's seeing these, you know, these areas areas which are like little walled cities where people are safe in their little burbs everywhere. And he says the view from outside is so powerful when you're an outsider. So to think, you know, to kind of yank yourself out of our kind of reticent, safe life and look at it from other views. Okay, so we'll do the prayers. And let's first do the long life prayer for Venerable Geshe Galtsen. The long life prayer for Geshe-la. Om Swasti, a mere display of the names of major and minor signs, along with the three sublime secrets of innumerable Buddhas, grants the glory of longevity. May the special enlightened deities of immortality grant today supreme and common glory and qualities. Pray thee an incomparable spiritual guide who mounts a wish-fulfilling gem of the sublime Dharma of scriptures and realization. On top of a victory banner, Geltzen, of teaching and practice, upon the roof of a jewel house of steadfast morality, Sultan. May you live long as a luminous body, a friend, lotus bloom with 100 petals of scriptural tradition, while eliminating completely the darkness of ignorance, you further the radiance of excellent intelligence. May you live long as a great spiritual guide who teaches the vital points of sutra and tantra according to Buddha's intention for people who are unruly and hard to tame, who have not been subdued by other Tathagatas. May you live long as a purveyor of benefits and happiness for beings who are tormented everywhere by unbearable pain due to engaging in negative karmic actions, shrouded in darkness of the five degenerations. May you live long as a great captain of the sea for miserable beings who have fallen to the ocean of samsara. May you guide them to the jewel island of complete liberation in your ship of the vast and profound Mahayana path. May you live long as a great spiritual guide who suitably teaches a variety of fortunate disciples the essence of Tsongkhapa's vast and profound tradition of excellence, which originated from the sweet oral transmission of Manjushri. In short, may the Siddhi secrets of the Guru be completely free of harmful agents and obstacles. May favorable conditions be effortlessly and spontaneously fulfilled, exactly in accordance with your wishes. May the blessings of the three infallible jewels, by the power of our single-pointed virtuous prayers, may the intended results spontaneously and quickly arise from their causes without obstacles in accordance with dependent arising. So I'd like to have us say some Om Mani Padme Hum mantras as well. Malin in the back lost his mother 2 days ago. 2 days ago, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 2 days ago, Malin's mother passed away. Her name was Yem Ye. And also Roselio Candelario has been diagnosed with cancer, who has 3 months, 2 months to live, but she has 3 children and her husband. So let's say prayers for these people. Om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum, om mani padme hum. Om mani padme hum, 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 om mani padme hum. We'll do the dedication of merit. And pray for the good rebirth for Malin's mother and for the smooth possible recovery from cancer for Rosalio. And as Geshe-la says, for all beings everywhere. Okay. Because of these merits, may I quickly become Guru Lord Buddha and lead each and every sentient being into his enlightened realm. May the precious bodhicitta that has not yet been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. May the precious view of emptiness, shunyata, that has not been received be received, and may that which has been received be increased and not decreased. In the land of snowy mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. Lord Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, may you stay until samsara ends. So, you know, this particular study and looking at our life, reincarnation and other lives, you know, it's like really an inner science, an inner analysis, really looking internally at what happens, you know, what creates the causes for our lives. And so, you know, it's like a Western model is constantly looking at the external, you know, and we've gone to the limits of incredible materialism that our planet, you know, since 1958, the population of humans has more than doubled since 1958. So, you know, there's some of us in here who were born before 58. and to think, you know, that the planet has more than doubled in our population, and the, you know, by the material knowledge and wisdom and science that we've created, we've created vast, you know, capacity for human life and prosperity. But at the same time, you know, we haven't done very much regarding our ignorance, attachment, and hatred. You know, this all of this is really an inner analysis that we need to do more and more. Okay, thank you. Sure. Virtue offering this to you. Feel eyes before me. This mandala built on a base, resplendent with flowers, saffron water, and incense, adorned with Mount Meru and the four continents, as well as with the sun and moon. May all sentient beings share its effects. Idam Guru Ratnam Mandala Kamniyataya. Traditionally, the teacher does not offer the mandala. So, you know, you'll hear, like, when Geshe-la teaches, usually it's a student offering it. So it's not the teacher offering the mandala for the teachings. So generally, the teacher would not initiate it. So it's coming from others. Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.